Hi, everyone. This is Gary, and I am on the line with Pablo, and we're going to do another campfire conversation. Pablo is calling from where he lives right now in Tel Aviv, Israel, and and that's why we're doing this earlier than usual, because he's in his evening time now. And so Pablo has a fascinating story. He and I Skyped each other before base camp even started, and just fascinated with his life, with his heart, with the glory of his life. And so now we've gotten to know each other even more through base camp and other conversations. And many of you have gotten to know him as well as you've read his blogs, under his profile page, and you've chatted with him and so on. So what I wanted to do, this afternoon is really kind of go through Pablo's story. And so Pablo, what I'd love to do is have you start with, where are things for you now? What are you wondering about? Last week we were on the phone with Jeff talking about transition, and you are in transition. So why don't we start there, and then I'll ask you the next question after that.
Okay. Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me, Gary. It's great to be here with you guys. Well, at the moment, I am somewhere where I have never really been before in my life. I've been in many places, I've done many things, but I find myself in a place where I really haven't ventured into before. I stopped my last job on the tennis tour as a coach at the end of July, and since then I have really been going through what Jeff very accurately calls a transition. You know, I am at a place where God is saying a lot of stuff to me. He has been doing a lot of releasing, a lot of healing, a lot of eye-opening for me. But as far as work and as far as the direction of my life, I am a little bit out in the frontier, like Jeff says. You know, I'm obviously looking for something to do. And in the midst of that, I'm obviously looking to discover more about my calling, my life. You know, God is bringing up a lot of stuff from my past, you know, prophecies, words of knowledge, stuff, things that people have said to me years ago. And I'm talking 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years ago. And even, you know, restoring and reviving things in me, you know, that I've put on the shelf for a very, very long time. I mean, some of the stuff has been there for like 10 years. And, you know, due to many circumstances, really, that took place in my past.
And, you know, and from our conversation earlier, I was asking you some questions, and one thing I'm very intrigued by is whenever a present occupation or assignment, as they talk about it, for a man kind of dries up or goes away, And it's obvious it was out of this man's control. So you've talked about how, you know, you just don't have anyone else at this point coming up asking you to coach them. And you're at a point in your life where you really don't want to pursue that career and that lifestyle now being a married man. And you know, I also see you, you know, actively going out and looking for what's the next thing for me, God? How do I provide for my family? And that's not coming up right away. That really makes me think, all right, God, what are you up to? It sounds like a major transition here when you're not him to go down the same path.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. You know, I mean, in the past, obviously, because obviously I was fairly successful in what I do for a living, every time I came to the end of a contract or I parted ways, the phone rang pretty much one or two days later, you know, with managers and agents and even players, you know, look, we want to work with you. What can we do? And when can we talk? You know, and if it wasn't agents or players, it was, you know, academies or, you know, people. And, you know, and even in this last job, the player I worked with, she did remarkably well. You know, she spent most of the time we were together inside the top 10 in the world. And so, this gave me a much bigger platform to become known by the world of tennis, you know, to the point where I was writing blogs for many websites, tennis websites, you know, I was on TV every week. So you would think that after that kind of job, even more so reason to get the phone ringing even before it did in the past. And yet there's been no phones ringing. You know, I've even written some emails and looked at things, you know, where obviously we coaches look, and nothing. I mean, absolutely nothing. And, you know, it's very strange because, of course, you know, this is where I've always made my living. I've been in tennis since I'm 7, 8 years old. I'm 40 now. But at the same time, you know, as I was telling you, during this year, which was the most successful year of my career, really the pinnacle of my career, there were many times where I was feeling like, you know, I don't even, you know, like when we were in a Grand Slam this year. I mean, we were in 4 Grand Slams, but the first one in Australia, you know, I was in Australia. We were in the Grand Slam, is one of the four pinnacle, you know, times of the year. Mm-hmm. And here I am in the Rod Laver Stadium on an evening match. The stadium is packed, 25,000 people, and the whole world is watching, and I'm there, the coach of one of the players playing. And it didn't do anything to me anymore, you know. It was like, I was like, this is almost like I've outgrown this, you know. I've done this just too many times. But, you know, it's almost like I don't have even the drive, the desire to go back into it, you know. It's almost like God has taken that away, which is very weird because I am at the pinnacle of my career, you know. It's not like I'm in a valley and everything is negative and then I can't really, you know, wait to get out. But quite the opposite, you know. I am really at the top of my career.
See, that's really fascinating, that here you are. This should be the point where your heart is most alive because you're actually experiencing what, you know, most people dream of and probably what you dreamed of at one point, and yet your heart is just saying this is not enough anymore. I mean, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
to be there. Okay, so go back to when you said you were 7 or 8 years of age and you entered into tennis, because obviously this has been a large part of your life, a large part of who you are, and obviously a large part of the glory of your life, where you wouldn't have probably succeeded nor lasted so long. So kind of, how did you get into tennis? What door was open for you?
Well, when I was about 7 or 8 years old, my mother was a club player, and she played socially, and obviously I needed babysitting, so naturally I was taken to the tennis club, and my first tennis experience was one day. I'd never been given a lesson or taught anything, and there was a racket lying around next to a wall, and I picked it up. I got an old ball, basically, and I started playing against the wall. And one of the guy who was giving my mother lessons once or twice a week, you know, saw me and said, to my mom, she said, he's been taking lessons. And she's like, no, he's never had a lesson in his life. And he says, that's impossible. Look at him play. And I'd actually had learned to play by watching my mother, you know, which was pretty remarkable, really. I mean, tennis is not an easy sport to play. And so my father heard about this, you know. I was also very good at soccer, which I actually loved and liked a lot more than tennis. You know, and I wanted to play that and pursue that even at a young age of 7, you know. And my father said, no, you are going to go and play tennis. And, you know, that was my first experience of my father basically, you know, telling me what I was going to do with my life, instead of actually allowing me to pursue what I liked. Then when I was, then I started playing tennis. I started getting coached. And by the time I was 9, I was the best. We were at the time, my parents and I are from Argentina, and so are my whole family, but my parents were working in Peru. So by the time I was 9, 10, I was already the best in Peru in my age group. And I went to the World Championships in Venezuela, which was the under 10s. And I finished 5th in the world then. And then, you know, I progressively began to play. And by the time I was 14, I was traveling around the world playing junior tennis, you know, and won numerous events, played in the U.S. Open juniors twice, you know. And my life just went like that. And when I was 13 years old, my father, in his wisdom, decided to ship me to America. So basically, he got me out of my house, you know, my home with my mom and dad, and he took me to America, to where my grandparents were living at the time. And, you know, I didn't really want to go, but he said I had to go, so I went. And, you know, that was the beginning of a very, very, a very resentful and painful time for me, because I came to my grandparents' house. My grandparents were raising my cousin, who was the son of one of my mother's sister. And basically, he was only a year younger than me, and the reason they had him is because my aunt was not a very responsible person, so they took him over. And so in that experience, I began, even though I did well in tennis, I began to basically get isolated, because, you know, my cousin was getting all the attention, because naturally they were like his parents, even though they were their grandparents. And I'll never forget one situation where my cousin was beginning to learn to fly. He was 14, 15, and he had an instructor, and my grandfather was paying for him to fly. And I said to my granddad, "Oh, granddad, you think I can go?" Because, I mean, flying was also one of the things that I always wanted to do, because my father worked in the airlines. But again, he said to me, no, it's too much money. You will never, you know, you will never make it. You just stick to tennis and just do tennis." And my grandfather turned around and said, no, your father can pay for that. I'm not paying for you. I'm just paying for your cousin. And so that was the environment I lived in and I was raised. And then when I was 16, I was basically shipped to a tennis academy. Again, I was on my own. And you know, again, I kept playing. It was all right. Then when the time came to decide whether I would go pro or stay on the tour, on the sort of like the collegiate, my father made that decision for me. He said, "No, you're going to college. You know, we got to back ourselves up. If you don't make it as a pro, you got to have a degree. And if then after the degree, if you want to keep playing, you can." But of course, that was not where I wanted to go with it. And so when I went to university, that's when I really lost control of my life. I got involved in drugs and, you know, started hanging out with the wrong people. You know, and it was a downward spiral from there, really.
Okay, so let me ask you first. Let me jump in. So, I mean, obviously there's pain involved, right? Tennis brings a separation between you and your family. You're shipped to the U.S. You know, then you're shipped off to this tennis academy. Everything keeps shifting on your life because of tennis. Are you still enjoying tennis, or do you not even enjoy it anymore?
I never enjoyed tennis, Gary. I think if you read Andre Agassi's book, I had a very similar story that Andre had. I actually played juniors with him and Pete Sampras and Jim Courier. I mean, they were my contemporaries. And Andre, the difference between Andre and I is Andre made it and made $200 million, and I probably made $200, and I never made it, you know. And we both experienced the same pain, the same journey. So if you read his book, you're reading my story, with the difference that, you know, he went across over to the pros because that's all his father wanted for him, whereas my father didn't really know what he wanted for me, so he kept shifting always the goalpost.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're playing something you're not enjoying. You're doing something you're not enjoying, but you keep getting pressed into it. You find no way out of it,
mm-hmm.
Right? Okay, so now you're at the university. You said you're kind of going wild. You're kind of living a life that, It kind of sounds like, okay, when you were living this life at the university, were you enjoying this life, or was something, or were you kind of saying, this isn't really the kind of person I want to be, but it's life, or what?
Well, no, I wasn't enjoying it because, of course, I had to study, and studying wasn't something that I liked to do, you know. Again, you know, I was having to play tennis in order to stay in university because I had a scholarship. So it wasn't a matter of whether you play because you want or you don't. You have to. And, you know, so, no, I wasn't enjoying, I was enjoying going out and picking girls up and drinking beer and getting high. Yeah, I was enjoying that, but I wasn't enjoying, my life was unfortunately one big survival stint through my teen years, you know. I had to sleep in the back of my car many nights because there was no money, or there was nothing, nowhere for me to stay. You know, I began to learn to lie to my father in order to keep him happy, because I knew that as long as I was on track to either get a college degree or make it in tennis, then he was happy. So I started to learn to lie to him. I realized that as long as I was doing what he wanted, he was happy and he loved me. You know, there were many times where I didn't eat for a couple of days because I had run out of money and I wasn't really working and my father wasn't giving me any more because he said that was enough, even though it wasn't. And so, you know, I mean, and that is just the surface of all that I went through, you know. I mean, I had some pretty traumatic experiences. And, you know, it was one huge, big survival stint. So, and as far as I was concerned, it was all to do with, you know, my dad, what he wanted me to do, and pleasing him, you know, and, you know, and really had no relationship whatsoever with him or my mother because, of course, I left home when I was 12, 13. So, you know, it was, for me, they were just good friends, you know?
Right. Okay. So tennis was work for you, always has been. It's always been driven by either your dad telling you this is what you're going to do or realizing this is what keeps him happy, you know, content with you kind of thing.
Yeah, correct.
But the amazing thing is you were a really good tennis player. Even though you didn't enjoy it, you really were good at it.
Yeah, no, I was very good. And I think if I would have been able to have somebody next to me who would have coached me the way I coach players, I would have definitely made it. I mean, I would have been a top 20, top 10 player without a doubt because, I mean, I beat a lot of the guys that made it. I used to beat them in the juniors. So,
So let me ask you, what you just described, how would that coach have coached you to make you into the one of the top 10? What would they have done with you?
Well, you know, the way I coach, I mean, I don't believe in coaching in creating a tennis player. I believe in creating an individual. And so I get very involved, you know, and a lot more than just hitting a yellow tennis ball because tennis at the highest level is, you know, the tennis ball and the racket and the court are just an excuse for the world to look at something while there is actually something else going on in there, you know, which is a far deeper experience and a far deeper world. And I would have loved to have somebody who would have come alongside me and would have believed in me, would have been able to stay with me all the time, not just, you know, when I was in the tennis academy, I had a different coach on a different court every day, but to have somebody one-to-one who would have also cared a lot more about me as a person, my heart, my dreams, would have looked out a lot more about me as an individual and not just be interested in me winning tournaments and doing as best as I could and doing it at the cheapest possible way and the quickest way possible, you know, in other words, not use me in order to create themselves a better CV, but actually make me feel like I was the most important thing in the situation and it wasn't them or their career using me for them to enhance that and look better at that, you know?
Right, right. So in other words, and guys are chatting about this right now, in other words, you were hoping for a father and a coach. What you didn't
have
all those years.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I never had a dad, you know. I mean, I know it will sound to you that really strange, but when I got into trouble as a 16, 17-year-old, I never, ever thought of calling home. You know, I always thought, how do I solve this situation? What can I do? I mean, I never had a mom and a dad that I could call and, you know, and just basically say, hey, mom, dad, I need help. You know, I'm in trouble. It just wasn't an option, and it never has been, you know, since I was 12.
Okay, so you didn't have a coach like this. They basically, I mean, to say the antithesis of what you said, they were interested in you only because of what you could do for the tennis team, the university, whatever. It wasn't you, and it wasn't you as an individual. And they didn't stay with you. They only were with you as long as it needed to be. What was it through all those experiences? And I realize we're just in your university years at this point. What did that teach you about how to make life work?
During those years, you mean?
Yeah, from all the experiences.
Well,
I learned
that I had to be someone I wasn't in order to be able to impress people so that they would like me and therefore help me and give me a hand. You know, I lived, there was not long ago, a movie where, you know, the person pretends, like this guy, Will Smith, 7 pounds, where he pretends to be a federal agent, but he actually isn't. And he uses that front in order to do other things. And that was me, you know. I pretended to be this person who was on his way to become the Wimbledon champion, when in reality, you know, I was just trying to survive. You know, I was just trying to use that front in order to survive. And, of course, you know, when you are different than everybody else and you do something like I did, you know, people are always interested. You're not a run-of-the-mill guy, so, you know, they take a liking to you. And so in high school, for example, my last year of high school, you know, I must have stayed in 5-6 different homes. You know, I was living with a tennis coach who, you know, was obviously helping me as he could because, of course, my parents didn't have any money to pay for it. But he would have friends come over, so I would have to get out and sleep in the back of my car, or I would have to try and beg one of my school friends to let me stay at their home, or I ended up staying with the PE teacher, you know, the athletics the guy, in his house for a month because my coach had his mom and dad come and stay with them. You know, it was like that. You know, that's what I was. And so in order to be able to get those things to happen for me, I had to obviously become somebody else who I really wasn't. You know, I was never able to be honest with people and say, you know, look, guys, I'm lost. I need help. You know, I am really seriously aching here. You know, I'm hurt.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, all right. So one more question before we move on out of the university years. Why were you such a good tennis player?
I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, I am obviously very gifted athletic-wise. The only thing that I can think of is God obviously knew that, I really can't answer that question. If I'm going to try and answer that question, I mean, you know, one of the things about, you know, coaching a tennis player, it's a bit of an art because you have to explain to the player what you are asking them or wanting them to do without actually, you know, them doing it while you're explaining. So in other words, you have to explain it in such a way that they can actually then incorporate it into the movement of their body and their mind and their heart and whatever. And that's why so many top players are not very good coaches, because they don't know how to explain something. They don't even know how they're doing it in the first place, because when you are that good, you don't even know how you do it. You just do it. It's like you were born with this innate ability to swing a tennis racket, you know? And so you find it very difficult to explain to somebody else, look, just do this, because you don't actually know the sequence of what is going on and how you produce that movement, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so for me to tell you why was I good, I don't know. I was just good. I was just very good at it.
See, that's absolutely fascinating, because you can do that for another person. But
I can now, yes, of course I can. I mean,
yeah.
I can... You know, that's what my job is. I mean, I am somebody who comes along the person and, you know, I change the way they play tennis, you know, but obviously I change a lot more than that. But that is ultimately what takes place on the court, the way they play.
Yep. Okay, Pablo, so keep going. Out of your or finish your university years. Keep going.
Okay, so I finish. No, I don't finish. I leave university. I realize when I get to 19 that I've had enough. I realize that, I can't go on like this. And I remember going outside of a church in Miami. I had a Jeep, an open-top Jeep that I've been able to buy myself through some money I got together. And I went outside a church, which the only reason I thought I knew was a church, because there was a cross on top of the building. And I said something along the lines of, you know, God, I have a lot of dreams. I've got a lot of things that I know I want to do with my life. And if you're interested, I want to meet you, you know. And that was 2 weeks before I went back for my second year of university. And, I went there and, I got together with my friends. We went drinking. And then one day I go to visit these four friends who were living together, or three friends. And there was another guy that had put in the dorm. And they said to me, listen, Pablo, whatever you do, do not talk to the guy who's staying with Ron over there. And I said to him, why not? He says, oh, he's some sort of these freaky Christian guys. You don't want to talk to him. Now, whether you believe it or not, I didn't actually know what a Christian was. I didn't even know really who Jesus was, you know? I mean, I had some sort of faint understanding that he was the guy who hanged on the cross, but why he did that, you know, I often wonder, why the hell did he do that? But I had no idea why he was actually up there, or whether he managed to get out of there, or, you know, he tried to get... I mean, I had no idea about this guy. So, you know, so I said, okay, cool, you know, so... next day, of course, I go and I knock on the door, and this guy opens the door, you know, this guy Al, and he, you know, he says, oh, he says, look, the guys have gone out, but they'll be back in 15 minutes. Come in. So I went in and I sat down and I started talking to this guy, and you know, and of course, in the back of my mind, this is the freaky Christian, so I'm just like completely very, very, very close, you know. And he says to me, are you okay? And I said, yeah, yeah, I'm fine. And he says, well, he says, you seem like you're uncomfortable. And I say, well, you know, I don't know who you are and blah, blah. And he starts to me, he starts to talk to me about God, you know. So I'm like, okay, I got to get out of here. And the amazing thing about that was, and I'll never forget this as long as I live, the minute he starts to talk about God, I had this overwhelming peace come over me, you know. The sense and the urge of getting out of the room stopped. And I literally felt, you know, something say to me, you know, you've called me, here I am. And, you know, I mean, you can, you know, you can understand that, you know, I pooped my pants, you know, because I thought, oh, my gosh, it's some spiritual crap here. I really, really, you know, but I was so peaceful about it, you know, but at the same time, I was crapping myself. And I was like, what do I do, you know? So I listened to him and I said, listen, I really need to go, man. I need to go to class. I forgot I got class. I didn't have class. It was Sunday, you know, but I really need to get out of here. I'm going, you know, and I got out, you know, and then everywhere I went, I mean, goes beside the point that I never went back to that apartment again in my life, but everywhere I went, whether I went to the toilet, whether I went to the library, whether I went to the ice cream shop, he was there. Everywhere I went, this guy was there. And eventually, you know, I said to him, listen, man, what is it? You're following me around. He said, no, man, I was beginning to think you're following me around. I said, I'm not following you around. Why would I want to follow you around? And anyways, we got talking, and I became friends with this guy. And we went out one night for dinner, and we were eating dinner, you know, and I started opening myself up, and he invited me to church. So I said, okay, I'll come along to church. So I went to a black American Pentecostal church. I mean, you can imagine. I went to church three times in my life before that, for my first communion, for somebody else's baptism, and one year in Christmas, and it was a Catholic church. And now I am in a black Pentecostal church in Miami. I mean, you imagine, for me, this was like a disco, you know. I mean, I thought, this is just unbelievable. Is this really your church? And he goes, yeah, this is his church. I said, but look at those guys dance and sing. I mean, it was incredible. So, of course, I loved it, you know. I had a great time. And after, I don't know, three Sundays, I became a Christian, you know. And I really went to the front because I wanted to get to the front to see what it was like at the front, because I was always sitting at the back, you know, and I really, that's kind of, I mean, I went forward because obviously, you know, I was convicted that I needed to do this, but at the same time, you know, I was curious. And and then I met the youth pastor, you know, and about 3 weeks later, a guy came to speak about the Holy Spirit. So I thought, you know, who the heck is he? And it was like, you know, I never heard of this guy either. I mean, you know, it's like I was totally out of touch with the whole thing. And he started talking about the experience and blah, blah. And so the next day I went to see the youth pastor and I said, hey, listen, John, I want to meet this guy, the Holy Spirit, you know. So the pastor started laughing. He was a really cool guy from Ohio, you know. And he said, okay, Pablo, well, look, all you have to do is we'll pray. And all you have to do is you just have to ask, you know. And I'm sitting there in the room and I ask, you know, and the AC was blasting in the room because it was a very hot day outside. And I asked, you know, Holy Spirit, you know, I want to get to, and I didn't even finish that. And I started speaking in tongues, and the room, there was like this fire that came in the room. It was amazing. I started sweating and I started crying, you know, and it was literally like I was feeling chains being broken off my body. You know, it was amazing. I mean, it was almost like I was taking, you know, like the superheroes that use this suit to camouflage themselves, you know, to hide who they are. I was beginning to feel like I was coming out of a suit, you know, that I had been living in all my life. And it was a remarkable experience. And, you know, I remember the scripture that says, you know, about how some seeds fall in hard ground, some seeds fall. And, you know, that experience there was, that seed went so deep into who I am and into the bottom of my being that, you know, I have been through the hardest times in life after that. But nothing has been able to remove that seed from inside me. You know, that seed, it's taken hold of me. And I know by God's grace, he will never let me go until the day I go to be with him, you know?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let me ask you, and this is fascinating. I mean, I'm just seeing the assault of Satan on your life and now the pursuit of God. Okay, so let me ask you, what happened with you and tennis. After you became a Christian, did anything start to shift or change?
No, well, yes. I actually that day after that, once I recovered myself, because it took me a little while to get over that, I decided that was it. I'm never playing tennis again. So I announced to my father that I was done with tennis. I went to see my coach in university and told him I was finished. Now, by that time, I had met a girl from the UK who then she became my wife later on. And then I decided that I was going to become a racing driver, which is another little dream I had when I was a kid, because I knew I had to tell my father that I was going to do something else. Otherwise, I was going to have him on my back. And I said, look, I've decided I'm going to be a racing car driver. I've met this girl from the UK. The UK is the best place to start this. I'm moving to the UK and I'm out of here. And my grandfather at the time, you know, he invited me to Europe. He paid for me to go over. So I went around Europe with him in a sports car. We did the whole of Europe, you know, for a month. And then I went to meet my girlfriend in the UK. And the thing was, you know, I never became grounded. I had these experiences with God, but nobody ever sat me down and discipled me and said, look, Paulo, this is what's happened to you. This is how you live now. You know, I wasn't really reading the Bible. I would read it from time to time if I was bored, you know, but I wasn't like, I didn't have a grounding of what actually had happened to me, an understanding of what I was supposed to do and not to do. I mean, I knew it was wrong to sleep with girls, but, you know, I really liked it and I found it really easy, so I kept doing it. You know, picking up a girl was very easy for me back then, you know, and so I was like, you know, I kept going, you know.
Well, and what's interesting, Pablo, is once again, now as a Christian, you don't have a coach, right? You don't have a father who's helping you along.
I had nothing. I was still pretty much fatherless. And, you know, I went obviously to the UK. I raced. I did single seater racing for a year. You know, I did really well on that, but then I ran out of money, of course. And then I'll never forget the day my girlfriend says I'm pregnant. And I said to her, you know, I was 20 years old. And I said to her, what do you mean you're pregnant? And I said, well, Pablo, this happens when people have sex. You know, I am pregnant. And I said to him, well, yes, I know this happens, but, you know, what you were supposed to be taking care of. And he says, well, I was, but, you know, obviously something's happened. I said, okay.
Something slipped through the cracks, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a bun in the oven, you know, and I'm like, okay, here we go. And so, you know, I mean, my whole world kind of crumbled, you know, and my first thought was, oh, my gosh, what is my dad going to think? And, you know, you can imagine the volume of thoughts that went through my mind of what to do in that situation, you know. I just basically said, okay, God, you know, I'm going to have to honor this and I'm going to have to take this. And so I got married, you know. And my wife then, she was also supposedly a Christian, but I think she became a Christian. Now I see because she wanted to be with me, not because she necessarily felt she needed to do that. And we got married, you know, and I then got a job in the UK as a tennis coach, which it was something I had to do because I had nothing else. I mean, I was not training anything. I didn't finish university. So I got a job as a coach, which I hated, you know, and I worked teaching, you know, all ladies. And, you know, here I am, a guy living in Miami has just been racing, you know, single seaters, and now I'm teaching all ladies how to play tennis. I mean, imagine the shift on that, mate. Wow. And, you know, and it was like, you know, 8 years I did that, you know. And so after 8 years, there was this coach that comes over, you know, and I started going to church. And obviously, you know, I started getting a bit more grounded and things began to obviously happen, you know. And we went to this church and this leader of this church sat down with me and said, look, Pablo, I need to speak to you. You know, I want to say to you that you have a very powerful, you know, destiny in your life. And I said to him, you know, I mean, you got to understand, I was totally unchurched, you know. And so I was like, okay, a powerful destiny, yeah, okay. So he says, you know, and I want to give you a scripture. I want you to always remember the story of Joseph. And he says, like Joseph, you know, what God is predestined for your life, only he can make it happen because it's too big. You cannot do it for yourself. So I said, okay, cool. So, you know, that meant really nothing to me. And that night I went to bed and I said to God, okay, God, you know, what does this guy mean? You know, because I really don't understand any of this. And in the middle of the night, I had this dream. There was like this voice, which was like, you know, like, when a river is full and it's full of rocks and the water is going through the river, you know, like the roaring river, that kind of sound.
Right.
All of a sudden, this voice said to me, you know, you're going to conquer the lands of the north for me. And I saw above the equator, all the countries above the equator, all on fire. And of course, I woke up because it was so real, you know, and I was shaking. And you know, all of a sudden, you know, I'm awake, and that was that, you know, and that was it. And so the next day I went to work, and life just went on. And I was there for about 8 years. In the seventh year, I begin to feel God speak to me and challenge me. And he says, I'm going to move you on to something else now. And I went to a training school in Nottingham, which was a Bible sort of training school. And I met some really good people there, and I had some fantastic, you know, events, prophecies, words. And I will share just one of them with you guys. An American guy came over, and very well recognized prophet. And, you know, he started telling some of the stories that he had, of prophecy he had, you know, of people that were doing these things and blah, blah. And then, you know, very powerful stuff. So I was very quiet in the back of the room, and I usually quite, you know, you notice me, you know, I'm not one of those guys that stays quiet, but when this guy started telling some of the things that he'd been up to, you know, and prophetic words that he had, you know, I was like, okay, I better not say anything because I'm going to get found out here, you know. And so then he comes all the way to the back of the room, he stands next to me, and he says, I got a word for you. And I said to him, really? And he goes, yes. And I go, okay. So I started repenting. I said, oh, Jesus, you know, I repent of everything I've done in my life. If I've missed anything, Lord, right now, I lay it at your feet, you know. And all of a sudden, you know, here we are, you know. It's like the guy says to me, look, God wants to tell you that in your past life, and he described my whole life. And then he said, you know, and God wants you to know that he's got a ministry of fire for you, you know, and that you have a powerful destiny. And that you're going to move in great power and might. And you think that he has, you know, he has missed your life, but he's been with you. And obviously, you know, I broke down because, of course, all of a sudden I realized I was not alone like I always felt, you know.
Right.
And then, obviously, you know, I finished Bible college and then I started preaching. I had some mighty, mighty times preaching, you know, so blind eyes open in the UK. Legs grow. I saw amazing things happen, you know, and, I then one day discover that I am being fired from my job, unfairly. I'm out of work, and then I spend the next, 6-7 months without a job. Then I secure a job, in a small island between France and the UK.
Okay,
I go there, I take, yeah.
Let me ask you real quickly before you move on. Under what grounds did they fire you? It was unfair. I realize that, but what were their grounds for firing you?
Well, we were in the training session with a bunch of guys, you know, and one of the, there was a 15-year-old guy there, and we were just basically bantering around. So I pretended to pull a Mooney, which I didn't, you know, and the boy then went home and said, oh, Pablo pulled his trousers down in the middle of the training session. And so the parents came, complained. There was a whole investigation, you know, nothing. They found nothing, you know. But then we later on discovered that the parents were going through a massive divorce, and obviously this whole situation kind of bonded them together again, you know, in unity for the family, because obviously the boy was distressed, and the boy was actually distressed for something else that the father was actually doing to him at night. We later on find out. But obviously he wasn't going to say that. So it was all Pablo's fault. And there was two investigations that went on and nothing was found, you know. And then all of a sudden, you know, one day I get called in and he said, look, we have to let you go because the father is threatening to go to the media and the media, you know, is going to make a balloon out of this and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, I took my employer to court and I won a settlement out of court, you know, they paid me money and but anyways, I was without a job, you know, I was basically without a job and, you know, even people from my, I was, 27 when that happened to me.
Okay. Keep going. Good.
And then I got this other job. I went to this place, Jersey, and I took over a club that was dying, you know. There was 45 children in the program, and within 3 years I had 310 and made a lot of money, did very well for myself. But my marriage by that stage was beginning to fall apart, you know. We had grown in completely different directions. I was actually getting really close, you know, really getting myself into God and really pressing into Him. My wife wasn't, you know, she was totally against it. And, you know, I had a wife that was very volatile, very angry. And, you know, what I didn't tell you, when I was a child, I saw my father beat my mother. And so every time my wife began to argue, those memories came to my mind. And so basically I said, you know, okay, we'll do what you want. And it was my fault. You know, I didn't keep short accounts with her. So whenever she wanted to hear yes, I said yes, even though I wanted no. And whenever she wanted to hear no, I said no, even though I wanted yes. And eventually I got tired of it, you know. And so, you know, she basically said to me, you know, there is absolutely no way that I need to change, Pablo. It's you. You have to keep changing. And by that time I had done a lot of changing, you know. And then it just went from bad to worse. And so we separated, and then by that time we already had two kids. Just before we separated, we had the third one. And that was another situation which obviously was totally unacceptable in the way that she went about that. Work-wise, I was amazingly successful in Jersey. I mean, that place went from being in nobody knew about it in the UK to one of the top three clubs in the UK out of 5,000 clubs. So, you know, it went from nothing to the best three in the country. And it was used as an example for all the other 4,997 clubs. You know, I was invited to conference, how to run a program. We became national champions. I mean, we were extremely successful. And then, you know, I was earning, you know, nearly $250,000 a year there, a year. And it was all,
okay,
I mean,
so
I took all.
So let me ask you real quickly, what did you do to make that club successful? What did you change?
Well, I did what I do very well. I took something that is very negative and everybody said it wouldn't work. And I dug my heels in. I worked my butt off. I persevered through thick and thin. I did not consider anything other than success. And I basically, you know, I went against the odds. I did things that were unpopular. I took risks that people said I shouldn't take. I basically just stuck to what I believed. And I set myself 20 goals the first year I was there. And by the fifth year, I accomplished every one of them, including winning the national championships, you know. And then, obviously, the opportunity came to go on the tour. And I went on the tour with a player that was 130 in the world. She had never been 100 in the world, never. She was 25, which was pretty much, you know, already set on her ways. Everybody told me, Pablo, you do not want to do this. Do not leave your job. So I went from earning $250,000 a year to earning $200 a week when I took this player. But I knew this was right. I knew this is where I wanted to go. I knew this was the next progressive step in my career. And I took that player in a year from 130 to 34 in the world. You know, then that opened the door for another player, which I took from 80 in the world to the quarterfinals of a Grand Slam and 18 in the world ranking. And then that then led to the next job, which I took this player from 67 in the world to 13 and literally just a top 10 player, you know, in the race for most of the year. And so, you know, this is basically the last 6 years of my life. And then, during this time is when I met my second wife, and she's Israeli. She's a Messianic Jew. And I got married, and I'm now living in Israel.
Okay. So you did a great job in 45 minutes taking us through all your life. That you did a great job. Okay. So let me ask you this question. I realize this can feel like, almost an embarrassing question to ask, but let me ask you again. You've had a very successful coaching career. What sets you aside? What makes you a great coach? I know you get asked this if you do a coach's clinic. What does Pablo bring that others don't? Because
I take risks. I take risks that I take risks that other coaches don't. I challenge players in ways other coaches don't challenge them. And I don't just challenge them tennis-wise, but I challenge them personally-wise. I see tennis in ways that most coaches don't see. I see things that most coaches don't see either. You know, and obviously I don't want to sound arrogant because, of course, that's not my heart. But, you know, this is where
right,
I'm good
yeah,
at.
You're and, safe here, yeah.
And, you know, and I am able to take an ordinary player and turn him in an extraordinary one. I know the keys that need to be turned. I've learned that. I know the secret and I do it, you know. You know, it's like, you know, I walk into a situation. I see everything and everybody looks like they're constipated because it's so negative. And I talk to them for 10 minutes, and in 10 minutes, I know exactly what I need to do the next 6 months, the 6 months after that, the year after, and the year after. And I know exactly where that player can get to. I mean, I've never, to this day, made a mistake when I said to somebody, I am going to take you to this ranking. I've only made a mistake with one player. I said to them, I'm going to take you to the top 17 in the world, and then she was 18. And but the other one, I said to her, I am going to take you into the top 14 in the world, and I took her. She was 13, and I said to her, and you're going to be top 10 in the race for most of the time that we're there in that year. And she was, you know, so.
Okay. So Pablo, what is it when you, and I love your two expressions I was writing down. One is, well, all the things you say, that you love to take risks. You love to get something negative and turn it in the other direction and make it successful. Perseverance. You stick to what you believe. You challenge players, you said, and you see things. Okay. So what is it that you particularly see in a player's life that you know is core to them reaching their goal of being a better player?
The thing is most of the players I've worked with didn't really have anything like that in order for me to say, right, I see that, so that means I am going. You know, I've taken three donkeys and I've made them and turned them to run like thoroughbreds. And that's the difference, you know. I've never worked with a player that I looked at and thought, you know, this is a pure blood stallion. I mean, this is a thoroughbred. All I have to do is just, you know, just butt him in the back every once in a while and just make sure that he does his thing. Every player I've had has not really had any of that core talent, that ability that you look at something and you go, they've had very little. And I believed that God has blessed me because I've been faithful with the very little that he gave me to begin with. And then he added more, you know, and these girls have accomplished things and done things that, to the, you know, that they don't even believe at times. I mean, I remember, you know, Shahar saying to me, you know, I've just beaten this player and I am in the semifinals of the Madrid Open, you know, and I'm like, yes, I know. She goes, I can't believe it, Pablo, this is happening. I said, well, believe it because it is, you know, and I remember Kaya walking up to me and saying to me, I'm in the quarterfinals of Roland Garros. And I said to her, yeah, you are, and you're going to go further. But of course, she didn't believe she could. She didn't even believe she could get there. But, you know, there's something about me that I almost like activate. I give life to a part of them that they don't even know they have, you know?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let me ask you a question for John, and then Sam's going to get on and ask you a question. And basically his question is, do you feel kind of duty-bound to stay with tennis right now? And the other question is, and what are you dreaming of doing?
Do I feel duty-bound to stay in tennis? You mean duty-bound in the sense that I have to stay with it because I'm supposed to, that's what I'm supposed to do?
I think so, yes.
Well, it's because all I've ever really done in my life, I mean, you know, I'm 40, I've been doing it since I'm 7. I mean, that's 33 years, mate. You know, before that, I didn't really have much of an understanding about life. So from the time I really began to be able to use my mind properly, you know, I've been playing tennis. I mean, that's all I've ever done. And if you think about it, the tennis court is a cage, you know, and I've been in that cage all my life. You know, if I go back there, it's because that's where I've always found my food, my sustenance, you know?
Right.
This is a major one, you know, and I think a lot of it of that is tied in with surviving and self-effort and doing it myself, you know, and all of that, you know?
Yeah. Yep. Okay. That's good. So the second part of John's question was, and what are you dreaming of right now?
What am I dreaming of? Well, you know, if I'm honest with you, at the moment, I am not dreaming of anything other than what has been awakened in me of dreams that I had 10, 12 years ago. Those dreams are beginning to resurface again. And those dreams are very much along the lines of, you know, preaching and obviously, you know, coming alongside people and leading them to Christ and doing things like that.
Okay. Okay, that's good. Sam, you are off mute, so why don't you go ahead and ask your question.
Hey, Pablo, this is Sam. Listen, we have just loved listening to your story. It's been great. And two different things that you said, one earlier and then one later, just jumped out at me. One is you said very early on, you said, nobody cared about me, my heart, my dreams. And, you know, that just was moving. That was just moving. And then when John's question is, you know, what about tennis? What made you successful? Excuse me, Gary's question, what made you successful is the question. You said, I gave life to a part of them they don't know they even have.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like in some ways you were doing to these tennis players the very thing that someone didn't do for you. You know,
yes.
You were caring about them, their heart, and their dreams. You were seeing into them something that they didn't even see themselves and something you didn't get.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as I listen to you, I think part of who you are is being able to offer the very thing that you didn't get, which is seeing into people, seeing their hearts, seeing their dreams, seeing into them.
Yeah, and I think you're right, you know, and I think that's one thing that most coaches don't do because they don't have the depth, the spiritual depth that I have. Mainly because they've never gone inside themselves and looked at their own lives. You know, they've always thought that coaching is about just changing others. But I think the most important thing as a coach is that you need to change first and you need to continue to change. And that as you change, so does the way you coach, because then you're impacting from a place of reality, not from a place of because I read it on a book or I learned it in a manual kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, and it seems to me that you've got this ability to actually help people find their dreams. You've got this ability to see into them and help them find the very thing that they can't find.
Yeah,
I think that's fabulous.
Yeah, thank you very much. You're very kind.
No,
yeah.
I think you're really gifted. There's something God has given you to make even these incredible pros become the person they're meant to be.
Well, you know, I have a gift of discernment, of the word of knowledge, you know, and I'm able to, I mean, it's happened to me when I've been in church settings where I've gone to speak, they've invited me, you know, I went to a businessman's breakfast, they invited me to speak, and I went up to this guy and I told him pretty much his whole life, and the guy wasn't even a Christian. He broke down in tears, became a Christian right there and then. You know, I then had, we were praying in a group, there was a woman there. You know, I had a picture about her hiding behind a wall, and God showed me that she had just been sexually abused. She was 14 and blah, 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 blah. And God wanted me to tell her that it wasn't her fault. And so I went to the pastor and I said, look, who is this lady? And she goes, she's just become a Christian. And I said to him, well, this is what I've got. And he's like, whoa, 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 whoa. You don't. And I said, well, look, I'm just going to share, but I'm not going to go to the jugular. I'll go around it. You know, I've got a bit of a diplomatic ability, so it's okay. I'll get it done, you know. And I described just the wall, and no sooner had I described that, she broke down. But I mean, she broke down heavily. And she started saying, I was raped by my father, my stepfather, my father, I can't even, or an uncle, somebody, it was a family member, you know. And anyways, it was a phenomenal deliverance, you know, and I was like, and I'm able to do that, you know, I'm able to sit with people and within 3, 4, 5, 10 minutes, I can see right through them and I can see exactly what it is that is in them, you know.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Okay, so now we're getting toward the end of our time. So, Jeff, you have a question. You are unmuted right now.
Well, I think more of an observation, Pablo, I was, the two words that kind of came out, restoration and reviving. And, you know, I think back about tennis in your life, and I don't think the question so much for you, do I stay with tennis or do I get out of tennis? Because one profession can't contain a man's glory so often. So no matter what it is, and so you see this with airline pilots, you see this with lawyers, you see this with doctors on top of their game. thinking about or wanting to do something else. And I, you know, it's kind of easy to look at, well, is this career holding me back from that? And so I actually don't think that maybe that's what's really going on with you. It isn't really the question, do you get out or not? But it is this idea, what is God developing in you? And clearly it's this idea to motivate, to give great insight into people, and that, you know, sometimes I think because you start so early in tennis, you were only 8 years old, that a lot of people don't have to reconcile with their career until they're in their late 50s. Then they're tired of it or exhausted of it. And so they press forward for another couple of years because I'm just going to hit 60 and retire. And they just deaden their hearts and get through it. But you're such a young man that you have to reconcile with this now, you know. And I think there'll be some reconciling with tennis. And I think God's doing that because he's taking you out of it for a while. It's unexplainable why you wouldn't get any phone calls after what you've done in your career. And mm-hmm. So I would kind of rest in that. I wouldn't be too anxious in that. And, you know, I don't know how long that restoration is going to take, but that's what I see. I see God wanting to restore you. And in my opinion, what I'm hearing is that I would, unless you hear something else really definite, I would think about staying with it, but expanding into what God is developing in you and what you love. And, you know, I love what you did in Jersey with all the kids and how that all got turned around. And, you know, I don't know, is there anything like that available, that you have a stable environment where you could, you know, raise a family and be married and yet work with kids? And they're the, you know, I could definitely see you having an effect on a lot of kids. So does that make sense?
Yeah, it's perfect. It does. And just to encourage you, I had a word not long ago about that God. I was in a season of restoration. That God was restoring all the years that the locusts had eaten, you know, and that He was sending new rain, you know, the late rain and the early rains into my life, and that, you know, it was a very. It's from the book of Joel, and. And that this was going to happen supernaturally, you know, the timing of it. So basically, you know, I hear you, you know, and you know that I have no problem in staying with it. But, you know, I'm just being real, you know. I mean, the doors are firmly shut. And, you know, I don't know if I'm, if you know, I don't really know. I don't understand that so much, you know.
Yeah, our stories parallel each other so closely, it's scary. You know,
yeah.
I grew up in the cockpit, you know, I'm flying when I'm a kid, you know, I'm a boy captain and all that. By the time I'm 40, by the time I'm your age, I just want to get out of flying. I just don't understand it. And yet what God was doing was developing something in me much more than just flying a leg from Charlotte to Milwaukee. And so that's what became more interesting to me, is what God was developing and then beginning to move in that. And I think speaking and you looking at the whole person looks more like what your calling is. That's what's beautiful about it. You know, it's one thing to teach how to swing, but it's one thing to go and challenge the person. Nobody's
and, you know,
doing that, and
yeah,
it's so neat.
I agree. I totally agree. You know, I mean, this is what I do as a coach, you know, and this is why sometimes part of the – you know, there might be a father that hates me because he's the reason that the player is not performing, and I take the risk and no other coach there, which is to tell him to get lost. Not
right.
Like that, but basically that's what I do. Then the player performs really well, and then eventually I might lose the job because the father is the father and I'm the coach, and of course the father will always be there. But I got the result that I knew I could get, and I was able to get. So I will go where people don't go, you know, and I will take risks that people will not take, you know.
That's exactly why you're such a good coach, is that you'll take the risk.
Yeah.
And you'll even remove things from a person's life to make them a better player.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have no problem in doing that, even though, you know, most people tell me I'm absolutely, you know, psychotic for doing that because I'm risking my job. And I say, well, you know, if I'm going to do this to take care of my job, I will never be the coach that I am. I am so much an artist when I work as a coach. You know, I do what I believe I got to do. And the consequences, well, you know, I leave that to the consequences. But, you know, if I believe I got to do something, I get it done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're a coach way outside of just tennis.
Yeah, I am, you know, and I think completely out of the box, mate. You know, I don't, you know, and that's why I've gotten out of the box results with players that were actually working with some amazing coaches, you know, big names that were never able to even, I mean, like the first girl, she worked with two unbelievable coaches that never got her past 105. And here comes Pablo, who's nobody, and gets her to 34 in the world.
Yeah, and we'll talk later because I got to know what you could do for me, man. Okay, let's let somebody else ask a question.
Yeah, go on.
Okay, so I'm going to mute you now, Jeff. And so I've asked everyone if they wanted to ask any more questions, and so far I'm not seeing anybody raise their hand. Let me throw this out, Pablo. As we're hitting an hour here, so that's perfect. Let me throw out a few things as Jeff and Sam were, and that is, it does seem like you have learned at a really deep, profound level what a person, a human heart needs. You've learned it through the absence of it in your life, and that's why I think it goes so deep with you. It's that, you know, it's that line out of the what is it, the kingdom of heaven, you know, with that whatever is delivered in pain goes deep, you know, when he slaps the kid and says, this is so you will remember it. And the father did to the son. I think what you have learned, your ability to understand what a father and a coach and a mentor is supposed to do comes out of a very deep place in you. And instinctively, like you said, a really great tennis player often can't explain why they're good because it's so instinctive. It's so deep. I think there's something very deep in you. I see it. You have this seeing ability. I think when you were able to sit and watch your mother play and you could pick up the game by simply watching her, that tells me you're able to see what needs to be done. What are the core things of the sport or of that life or of whatever it is?
I just tell you that I also learned how to drive like that?
Okay.
I never had a driving lesson in my life. When I was 11 years old, I told my parents, I can drive. And they said, Pablo, you're 11. I said, look, Dad, just take me in a back road and I'll drive. And my dad took me in the back road, you know, obviously got the seat right up to the, and I drove a stick shift, not even an automatic, a stick shift. I drove. And that was like, I did that by watching my mother drive.
Okay. That's fascinating. So see, there's another example of it. And I loved when you told the story, you said, I can watch a player and within 6 minutes, I can tell how I can get them to their goal, how I can turn this around.
Yeah,
that's really huge. Yep. And then of course you just talked about having word of knowledge. I mean, this all goes together with whatever we want to call this thing. And the other thing is that this is so much in the opposite direction of what you learned at a younger age about how to make life work. When you said, you know, I just learned how to be somebody I wasn't to make it work. And everything you've done in tennis, and more than that, as Jeff was saying, you have been teaching people how to step out of that and step into who they are, you know.
Yeah, that's
realizing,
right. Amen.
Teaching them that you're going to get stuck here if you stay in this. And so, okay, so this is what I want to say to you, Pablo, and I think we all want to say to you, and that is this. You have great clarity to your life. You know this. You speak with great clarity about who you are, what you've gone through, what you can do. You are a very gifted man. You have this really honorable aggressiveness about you, which is really good. And so somehow God is, it appears that he is thwarting your ability to stay, you know, in that route, that direction of tennis. I mean, not only is Satan a thwarter, but God can thwart as well because he's trying to get us to something better. He must be doing that because, like you said, there's no explanation that this isn't continuing with you, tennis. And so I want to say a couple things. One is we're with you. In this point of mystery in your life, we are all with you.
Amen. Thank you very much.
With you. Yeah, feedback, encouragement in every way we can. The other thing is, and you and I have talked about this, that, you know, I don't know if God is saying you will step into the next big thing immediately, or if you may be saying, you know, Pablo, I'm going to get you there, but you've got a transition. You may have some transition things to do in the meantime to bring income in. I don't know, but let me just say to you one more time, you know that nothing in life is permanent.
Amen.
So if you ended up doing something you don't want to do for the rest of your life, it's not permanent. You're safe in that. And if we feel like you're getting stuck, we'll say something to you.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So I would say, Pablo, just offer what you continue to offer, what you have, how you see, you know, in whatever unpaid small ways you have right now, because it's powerful. And we in Basecamp need your seeing in our lives as well. We really do.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that, because today I was going through the membership and I looked at a couple of profiles, you know, and as soon as I looked at them, you know, it's like, boom, I saw two or three things, you know, and, you know, but I'm just feeling my, and I've written those down. So don't worry for those two people who you are. And don't worry, guys, there's none of you guys here tonight. It's a couple, well, that I know that you are here. It's for a couple of other guys. And, you know, and again, it's just stuff, you know, that comes to my mind. And the problem, the biggest problem with me is I survived so many years through doing, it's very hard for me to rest and just stop doing, you know. I have to always be doing. And, you know, I know that is not necessarily good with God, because, you know, I have to come to the end of my road, and that's where he's waiting for me. You know, I think sometimes, you know, and I heard this today in this podcast, you know, it's not chocolate, by a guy called Wayne, whatever his name is, that Jeff gave me. And apart from the fact that it was hilarious, you know, it speaks about, you know, often God will not, you know, when he looks at you going with all this effort, he's like, well, you know, Pablo, I am not going to endorse that, because that's not where I am, you know, and it's a little bit like religion. Do you know what I mean? And,
mm-hmm.
This is what I'm, you know, all my doing, my wife says to me, you know, you do not know what you're worth, Pablo. You know, you do not know what you are worth. And this is my new wife, you know. She says, you know, you're worth, there is something in you that I've met some pretty big people, you know. I mean, she's met Shimon Peres, and she goes, and you have something in you that is unique. There's something in you that is very, and please, guys, I'm not being arrogant. I'm not trying to blow hot air up my blouse here. You know, I'm being very open and vulnerable with you guys, you know. So I'm just sharing because I want you guys to know me for who I am. I want to be real with you. I don't want to pretend to be someone I'm not. I did that for too many years. But yet I don't necessarily see that, Gary. You know, I don't necessarily see that, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, and let me say, you are very safe with us just to speak what's on your heart and what you know without having to edit it and nuance it so it doesn't seem prideful. We know you, and you're safe with us in this. The other thing is that, and Vern really kind of nailed it, is he kind of chatted the idea of how does God get the message to us that he wants us to stop doing and rest for a while. Mm. And I think that's probably what God is up to with you.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if we can help you do that, that's what we want to do.
Well, you know, Gary, I said to you at the beginning of the conversation, I've never been in a place like this. And the thing about it is, you know, I would be going berserk now. It's been 4 months that I've not been working. And I mean working like, you know, on a court and inactive. And yet I have this serenity and this peace about it that is beyond anything that I could muster up myself through any good centering and zoning myself. You know, I'm very good at all of that because I can do that, you know. I mean, I've been in the tennis game for so long, I can go very deep and I can zone myself. But this goes beyond that. This, the peace that I find in me at the moment and the serenity is beyond any acquired skill that I have, that if I'm in a panic situation, I can still slow everything down inside me, that even though there's things flying around me, I'm still in control, you know, of myself. And it goes beyond that. And so it's got to be God, you know. It's got to be God. It can't be me.
Yep, yep. So, Pablo, thank you. This has been really good, and you have been just right out there with your life. And so not only do we appreciate you just sharing your life with us, which is huge, but I know we've all been – something's been stirred in each one of us. That always happens when you hear another man's story. So thank you, and we'll be talking some more, all right?
All right. Thank you. Thank you, guys, for listening.